Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Da du sikkert lei av å høre meg snakke om hvor enkelt det å levere skattemeldingen med fiken. Så vi gir oss her. Fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken. Superenkelt regnskap.
Welcome to Ukraina-podden from Nettavisen. My name is Tormod Mollensæter. I'm a journalist there. And today I'm co-hosted with...
Jørgensen Henriksen. I'm a Ukraine columnist at Nettavisen and leader of the Norwegian-Ukrainian Friendship Association.
And today we're doing this in English because we're so lucky to have Mr. Ihor Holovchenko charge the affairs at the Ukrainian embassy in Oslo. Welcome to us.
Good morning, everyone.
We're very pleased to have you here. And as usual, we'll start with a brief summary of what's happening in the front line the last couple of days. Jørgen, you want to go ahead?
Yes, it's not a lot of news since the last episode. The most intense fighting is in Avdiivka still. And it is basically the same pattern that has been in the last couple of weeks. The Russians are attacking fiercely with large concentrations of forces. And they're beaten back with heavy losses. Sometimes they take a few meters and sometimes the Ukrainians counterattack and take that back. But the overall picture is that the Russians have immense losses, both when it comes to personnel and materiel, without getting much land from it. But we have also seen that Ukrainians have stepped up, or we don't know if they've stepped up, but we've gotten information that indicates that maybe they do it all the time, attacks behind the lines with both drones and missiles. And some interesting attacks is that they have taken out two old oil depots in Donetsk city. And there are indications that the Russians are struggling with fuel, which is interesting because Russia is basically a gas station funding a war machine. But because of sanctions and different logistical issues, they have to move different types of fuel around, jet fuel, fuel for their tanks, fuels for heating and stuff. And that logistics is challenging to them. And also, every time they lose a depot, they have less storage capacity, which makes this logistics even more difficult. So, big picture on the front right now, Russians losing a lot of people, and also further back, their logistics is getting tighter and tighter on different issues, especially right now, fuel is interesting.
Yeah, and those logistics line has been under pressure for a long time. I think we made or I read news about it earlier this year, like in January this year, probably that they had like almost no opportunity to save fuel close to the front. Like everything they used had to be brought there, so that makes it difficult.
Yeah, and we saw even if. Very first days of the full-scale invasion that the Ukrainians prioritized hitting fuel trucks. Sometimes I saw, especially in the south, some situations where they let the tanks through and then they hit the fuel trucks that came behind them and then the tanks run out of fuel. So this is a well-known tactic that they're continuously using, and Russia is running out of fuel trucks. They're running out of train cars that carries fuel. The train that was hit in Siberia is an example of that. And now also the different depots that I've hit both in Crimea and also in Donetsk and other parts of the front and also in Russia proper.
Yeah, and now we'll would like to have love to have your thoughts on how the war is going and the current situation. Like the last half year has been more difficult than the same time last year when Ukraine won back both Kherson and Kharkiv. This year it has been a lot tougher for the Ukrainian army. And how do you like see the situation on the ground nowadays, Mr. Holovchenko?
Yes, thanks for this assessment. I would say that they're mostly correct. The main tool which Russia still uses in its war is a huge manpower reserves it has. So even after almost 2 years of the full-scale invasion and immense huge casualties and losses of heavy arms and vehicles and planes, we Ukrainians are still facing a huge military machine, which is heavily financed by Russian easy money from selling fossil fuels abroad. and huge numbers of personnel mobilized by Russia. They are ready to send more and more human waves, losing 1,000 people per day. And that is the way how Russians get used to have wars. This is the way we have seen in the Second World War. And my nation was also a part of this tragic way of leading the wars, in which thousands and hundreds of thousands of people were dying due to mistakes and misplanning by generals in Moscow. Now we see the same pattern, the same tactics in Ukraine. And that is one of the big differences between us and Russians. Ukrainians, we like to live. We like to enjoy our lives. We like to support our families. We don't want to die. We want to win. But we don't like this Russian way of suffering. And that is one of the big features, I would say, why we do not want to be a part of Russian Empire anymore. We faced too much tragedies, including Holodomor 90 years ago, that we know too well what it means to be a part of this so-called Russian world. That is what we are fighting for. We want to be a sovereign, independent nation, which chooses its own way of living. We don't like this Russian way of living and Russian way of dying. So Avdiivka is, in fact, yes, a very good example of how the battlefield looks like now. We try to counterweight Russia's immense manpower reserves by our ability to fight better, to plan better, to use better technologies we have, West-provided weapon systems we have, and to try to spare our lives, the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. So, as you rightly mentioned, there were no major changes in what regards in the map. So the front line has not shifted in the past several months. That is why, because we have this balance, huge manpower and casualties from one side, and our intention to use scarce resources we have to the best possible extent on the other side. What we need to change that balance and to come back to the ability to hold wide-scale operations like we had in 2024 in Kharkiv and Kherson region is to ensure two things. First, we need sustainable supply of military, most notably sophisticated high-tech military support from our partners. And our second big task is to establish production in Ukraine. That is what we are now working on, including with Norway, to engage those industrial capacities to be deployed directly in Ukraine, because it would greatly enhance our capacity to sustain military operations when we don't need to bring the damaged tanks to Poland or to other country or to Lithuania to have some repairs. When we will be able to do that very close to the battlefield, it will drastically improve the situation. We need huge amounts of artillery ammunition, and it would also be much easier for us to produce it directly in Ukraine. It is possible even now when missiles and drones are in the air. Still, Ukraine is a big country, so we do have those possibilities to ensure that.
Yeah, and it's also very interesting to hear about the work Ukraine do on the defense tech involvement. Like you mentioned that you want to, you really started to work on making your own defense material, and it's led by this guy, Mr. Alexander something. He used to be the guy being in charge of the train traffic in Ukraine. I think he's now running the his
Kubrick Hall.
Yeah.
About infrastructure?
Yeah. I interviewed him last year, I think.
Something he leads is the Minister for Strategic Industry.
Yes. Something exactly. Like that. Yes. So that is the ministry which is, so we have MOD, mm-hmm. which performs its classical function, and yes, Ministry of Strategic Industry, which works on that. Of course, in close cooperation with the MOD and other stakeholders, including the MFA.
Because I think it's also important for you to start making more of the stuff, being able to make more of the stuff yourself, because we see kind of the support for Ukraine is not as strong outside as it used to be, like 1 year ago. Like I think the support is still strong, but it's not as strong as it used to be. Is that a correct assessment? Or how would you answer to...
It depends on a country. So there are elections in different countries. There are new regional crises and conflicts which impact some countries more than others. For instance, like Middle East definitely influences Mediterranean countries more than it does Norway, for instance. So I wouldn't make it a general picture. So it depends on specific country. For instance, EU is only strengthening and enhancing its support and long-term capacities. Yes, we are now in the middle of these negotiations on this big package of 50 billion euros for the next several years. We are quite optimistic that it will take place. Yes, there are discussions in the US and the women elections ahead. But I mean, I wouldn't say that the trend is clearly positive or clearly negative. So it is, as I said, it is different. Norway has been one of the front runners in this regard by introducing a Nansen program in February this year. And one of the very good examples of long-term support, which is not dependent on the forthcoming elections or some minor changes of mood within the population or whatever. And that is what we also seek to establish in our partnership relations with other countries to make this support long-term of long-term character.
Yeah, this is very interesting. The things that you mentioned with other crises around the planet that takes focus and not doesn't necessarily mean that the countries don't have the capacity to also support Ukraine, but it takes a lot of political and strategic focus and the attacks on shipping that goes through the Suez Canal now with from Yemen is interesting in a Norwegian case because it looks like we'd need to send some naval assets, possibly a frigate, down there to the new task force, and our support for Ukraine hasn't been mainly on the naval front, but it will tie up some attention in our both military and foreign policy sphere. So it makes me slightly nervous, but hopefully it's unfounded. But I see why it's important for you to get more of your military production at home, so that you're not as dependent on support as you are right now. What you mentioned about Russia and the way they attack and their life, how they don't value life much, it's almost like they measure military success in how many people they've lost. You see that in how they talk about World War II. And there was an analyst yesterday I listened to who said that Russia is coming close to losing the amount of people in this war as the U.S. did during the whole of World War II, both in Europe and in the Pacific, while Russia brags about how many people the Soviet Union lost. And many of them, as you say, like Ukrainians, were put to the front first. And when they were shot, then more prioritized units were set in. And it's almost like we see this in this war as well, that they sort of brag about how intensely they're fighting by the number of people lost. It's a sort of logic that doesn't make sense to us in the West at all. How do you fight that? Because in a normal country would have given up by now by losing so many people.
It is a big challenge for society. So, of course, families lose their husbands, sons, and fathers. That's why, as I said, we appreciate wives. So we value wives, and we do our best to protect the wives of soldiers. This is very different to this Russian way of doing things. So we also need to understand that the economical capacity of Ukraine is much lesser, especially now during the war, to support. So we cannot support, for instance, several million army.
No.
We simply cannot do that. Even with heavy financial external support, which we cannot use for direct financing of the war. So it goes to support our budgetary and social commitments of the government, and then taxes go to support military. So we are neither Russia nor China nor the US. We have very strict financial limits in what we can do.
Yeah.
And that is why whenever anyone tries to undermine this external support by saying that you should not give money or weapons to Ukraine because it is a corrupt country or whatever, then the answer is very clear. We cannot allow ourselves to be corrupt because we have scarce resources and we need to use them in the most effective way. If we don't do that, we will simply lose the war. So this is our way of survival. So any military support provided by Ukraine goes very well. It is used in the best way. That is simply our only option.
Yeah.
And it's also hard to be corrupt with a F-16 or a Leopard tank. It's like it's not.
You cannot sell it on your market in your home city just to some granny.
Yeah, I can't afford it, but I would be interested in buying an F-16 if it was available. But that's a very interesting point. And yesterday we had Ine Eriksen Søreide, the former foreign minister of Norway. She was the defense minister when Russia invaded and annexed Crimea in 2014. That episode airs on Christmas Day.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, and she talked about this, so you should listen to that episode when it comes out. But she spoke about this corruption narrative that Russia is pushing. And we see it here in Norwegian discussions, but especially in the US. And yes, corruption exists in Ukraine. It's not anywhere near as much corruption as there is in Russia. But this narrative that what we're sending is sort of evaporating when it arrives, that is part of a very massive Russian disinformation campaign that everyone should watch out for when they're consuming information about this war.
Yes, and they have been waging this propaganda campaign long before the full-scale invasion, even before 2014, I would say. My last posting as diplomat was to Austria, to Vienna, to the OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And my primary job was the topic of Russia's aggression against my country. So I dealt a lot with Donbas and Crimea. We had weekly meetings, which are called permanent council meetings in Vienna every Thursday. So, and within the circle of these 57 nations comprising the OSCE, we had lengthy discussions with Russian delegation. That is basically what OSCE does. So it is a platform for exchanging views. This is not to agree upon something or to introduce sanctions or whatever, like the UN Security Council does. This is a place to present your position to other countries. And that is a long-established narrative for Kremlin to say that Ukraine is a failed state, which does not deserve to exist as a sovereign state, which does not deserve to receive external technical, financial, humanitarian, whatever you might say, economic support, which does not deserve to have its own trade policy. So this is big element of their campaign to undermine, to erase our identity and sovereignty and to restore this Russian empire, which is still in the heads of big bosses in Kremlin. We will soon have, or we already have, the Soviet Union of 1980s, when a group of very old men with very old views on the way how things should be done take the decisions which influence dozens of millions of people.
Yeah. And also, while waging this campaign about Ukrainian corruption, Russia at the same time was the cause of much of that corruption and were sort of pushing that corruption themselves. So sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they were pushing. So
yeah, exactly. Cheap Russian gas was one of the main sources of corruption in the 1990s, because there were still strong links between the bureaucrats and the elites and the big private owners in Ukraine and Russia, and cheap gas was a good source of it. Not only for Ukraine, by the way. I believe you have heard of dozens of examples when European politicians were also made dependent on easy money provided by Russia.
Yeah.
So as a politician in Europe, it is hard for you to earn huge amounts of money because everything is transparent and the law system has been established for decades. So you're always very aware of making profits on these links between business and government. But then if Russian guy comes to you and offers huge easy money, some cases it was too easy to accept it. So this is the way they were doing their business, and that is why now decoupling of European energy market from Russia is a huge decision, which not only decreases the profits earned by Russia and decreases its capacity to sustain a military machine, but also has a huge impact on future generations, because the next generation of European politicians has lost its potential corrupted links with Kremlin.
Mm.
Now the Kremlin's possibilities to influence decision-making in European capitals has been severely undermined.
You're kind of cutting it along with the gas pipes. So like when the gas pipe is closed, it also closes Russia's influence on Europe.
Yes, that is a very direct link, yeah.
But something we kind of, we have not mentioned it directly, but is the Black Sea. And you talked about Ukraine's need to, like, the war makes you struggle with the economy as well.
Mm-hmm.
The export of grain and other mm-hmm. products out of the Black Sea is extremely important for your economy. And I think maybe it's under-communicated how important the Battle of the Black Sea is and how successful it has been for Ukraine as well. Like, yep. Considering Ukraine is a country without a navy, you still managed to push away the Russian navy, which is what's considered to be one of the greatest navy in the world.
Yes, that is maybe the major breakthrough for us in the past half a year, that we managed to establish a pretty safe sea trade route from the Black Sea ports, which are not temporarily occupied by Russia. The last numbers I have seen were quite impressive. So it's been 4 months since this trade route has been established, and now it's nearly 10 million tons exported by it. It started almost from zero. Now, during the past months, it was almost 5 million tons exported by sea. For your better understanding, before the full-scale invasion, this number was 6 million. So now we have almost reached pre-war level of export.
So you're at 5 of 6?
Yes, 5 of 6. When the Black Sea Grain Initiative was in force from summer 2022-2023 until Russia left it, the middle number was 2.53 million tons. So now we are able to export almost twice more than we were able to do through this UN and Turkey mediated agreement. And that is a huge breakthrough, which really demonstrates that by technology and good use of them, you can reach much better results than by simply having huge numbers of weapons and people.
The Battle of the Black Sea is one of the most impressive things that has happened so far in this war. And like you talked about earlier, that's technology that is produced in Ukraine. The surface sea drones has been used for the first time in war, and they're produced in Ukraine, and they've made several generations of new technology on them, and are both expanding their blast power, their reach, and their ability to to hide by diving and stuff. So they basically pushed most of the Russian Black Sea out of Sevastopol and further east in the Black Sea. And that's before they've gotten F-16s. So when they now get F-16s as well, they will have aircraft that are able to defend themselves, but also carry anti-ship missiles like Harpoon or maybe even the Norwegian-produced Penguin missile. And then it's going to be even more difficult to be the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. So that is a success we need to remember, and it will also make it easier for those small maritime forces that Norway has helped train that are now fighting in Kherson, crossing the Dnieper River, and have also conducted raids on the Krim Peninsula, and hopefully we'll do that even more next year.
Yeah. And what does it mean for your economy to now be able to export twice as much as you did during the Black Sea Grain Initiative? Like, it has, I guess it has to really impact your economy?
Yes, definitely supports our export capacity, so we can earn more money by our own and to be less dependent on external financing. And we are still a big agricultural leader. For your comparison, so when I was a kid, my father was proud that with 50 million of population, Ukraine was able to harvest 50 million tons of grain. Now, in 2023, during the full-scale invasion war, and with population of nearly 40 million, maybe less, having in mind that several millions left as refugees, we have harvested 80 million tons.
Yeah.
80. With 40, that's not 50 to 50 during the war. So we are, when we speak that Ukraine is a food security provider, so we have something behind that is not simply words, that those are not dead words. Yeah. And we have a well-functioning market economy as well. I always stress that the full days of the full-scale invasion have demonstrated very clearly that we do have a market economy which did not collapse. Because if we had a Soviet-type authoritarian economy, it would simply stop. Hmm. But then, even in the worst days, in the worst few days, we had banking system functioning. People could buy food, people could buy fuel, and mobile communications were working. So Of course, a major part of private companies stopped, but the basic needs were still insured. We didn't have a food crisis in shops. So I can share some personal memories, of course, of these big malls in which suddenly your range of foods from 200 positions was decreased to maybe 40 positions. And there were huge piles of the same products because the company was struggling with logistics to organize that. Mm. But no one was waiting in a line for several hours to buy a bread. What, in fact, I did yet in the Soviet Union. I was born in 1984, so I was 7 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed. I still recall my childhood when I was a kid and I had to wait for 3 hours in a line to buy bread in a peaceful country. Now, in a country in a war, I don't have to do that.
Yeah.
So there are things in the past and things in Russia to which we definitely do not want to return.
Hmm. That's a crazy comparison with the bread queue in the 80s and not in 2022. That's a picture never heard before. But yeah. But if we talk more about when the full-scale invasion started last year. Where were you then? And how did you get to know about that Russia escalated the war and actually invaded you?
I woke up at nearly 6 a.m. One of my colleagues called me by mobile phone and told me that wake up, it has started. Mm. And so I jumped out of the bed, came to the window. So at that time we were living in a high multi-apartment block building in Kyiv. It was fourth floor, and I looked down on a parking for cars, which was right behind in front of my windows. And I saw several people with big suitcases running to their cars and going out of the city. And so we were like warned that this could happen. So we were, I would not say ready, but we knew that it could happen. Mm. You can never be ready for war. Mm. So I used public transportation as I always did to get to the MFA. Not sure how many details I can share on that, but on the same day we heard loud explosions in the downtown, and we were instructed just to leave the building of the MFA and to go to work online from our homes because the state could simply not allow effort to lose all diplomats in one place if some of the missiles would hit the building of the MFA. So that is the way how the first day of the full-scale invasion looked for me. Yeah.
But you have to just tell us if you can't share in details, but how, what do a diplomat do the morning their country gets invaded? Like you go to the MFA and like you don't, I guess you don't do your normal morning meeting. Like where do you start?
Well, I was... Okay, let me say in this way. So people were doing things they were supposed to in the case the full-scale war starts. Mm. So of course it was not regular just sending reports or...
But you had a plan that you were doing.
Yeah, so we had some pre-arranged tasks. So every department every department knew what to do. Of course, it was quite chaotic. Of course, it was very much dependent on persons. So someone was taking into account his or her family needs. Someone drove directly to the MFA when it started. But the general picture was that every... like part of the MFA knew what to do and tried to do that. There were heavy challenges also related to the IT because we experienced cyber attacks in the night when the full-scale invasion started. We had to follow some security protocols designed specifically for some situations, which also impacted that. And then embassies abroad also started doing what they could. What I know here from my colleagues who were there in Oslo, that the first few days of the full-scale invasion, the embassy was fully packed by humanitarian aid boxes that people were just kept bringing to the embassy and asking what Norwegians can do to help. While in some other nations, some other countries, the picture was different. So it is very individual. So you cannot take it as a one general approach, I would say.
Sure. I was in the embassy in the start of March last year during a press conference from your former, from the former ambassador. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was, as I said, it was packed with like different aid, and a lot of military helmets was laying in cardboard boxes, and it was... It was a lot of stuff there, and people were constantly working, packing it, and it seemed very busy. But yesterday, President Zelensky had a press conference, which was quite a contrast to the press conference held in Russia last week. And I think the biggest take maybe from yesterday's press conference was a comment from Mr. Zelensky that the army has requested to draft 450 to 500,000 soldiers, and now there's like it's not decided that it's gonna be done, but could you kind of explain to us what the discussion is about, because Ukraine obviously needs all the soldiers they can get, but still there's a discussion if they're going to mobilize or not. You, with your job, you can't have like a personal meeting public and what should be done, but could you try to explain what the issue is?
There are several issues related to mobilization, and one of them, as I mentioned before, we simply have economic constraints with which we cannot mobilize hundreds of thousands of persons at one time as Russia can. So we need to be very careful in this planning. Point number two, again, as I said, we try to spare lives. We don't want people to die just as a cannon fodder. So we try to use it as effective as we can. And that is why, for instance, several weeks, I believe, ago, a new project was launched, which is called recruiting. So now if you want to join the armed forces of Ukraine and you have some profession and you want to follow this profession because you would be most effective in it, you can apply directly with the help of several private recruiting job companies to do that. So the idea is that we need to engage those people who are very good in something to keep doing their civilian job as a military. If you are an IT guy, so you should be sent to control drones, not to attack positions. Give me a personal example. So I visited a conscription center for them to verify my data as a potential military conscript in the beginning of this year. I saw one of my neighbors. He was a 50 plus years guy who served in the Soviet anti-air defense troops forces, or whatever, yeah. Forces. So he was called to the conscription center, and as far as I saw it, they were going to draft him to serve now again 25 or even 30 years later, but using the Western provided systems. So of course, this is a different technology. 30 years have passed, but still he had much better understanding of how it works than anyone else like me or you or anyone else. So this is the idea. So people with qualifications should be sent to that troops in which they could use this qualification the best. And that is also the idea that we do not need to do massive one-time mobilization. We need to do it smart. Likewise, we do it smart in fighting, in planning, in doing logistics or attacking logistics, as you mentioned. So we need to be smart.
That's a very interesting contrast to how the Russians are doing it, because this news that came now that the UK and Norway will cooperate to rebuild the Ukrainian Navy is interesting, because building a navy takes time. Running a warship has very specific tasks where you need a lot of training and knowledge, like radar operators and things. So that takes time to build up. And we've seen reports that the Russians have pulled sailors from their Pacific Navy to Ukraine and used them as infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of an extreme example. Somebody that has been trained for years to operate a operations room in a frigate, for example, where you need a lot of different skills that takes years to train, is sent in as infantry and just shot. And that's sort of a massive contrast. How you describe how you use skills and past experiences to do smart mobilization, while Russia is just interested in the number of bodies that they can mobilize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and also when you're you're not the ambassador to Norway, but the charged affairs, just mm-hmm. like the working ambassador. What kind of tasks do you have in Norway? Like, how do you represent Ukraine here in Norway? What is your job?
I'm basically a political counselor, so deputy ambassador, like number two in the embassy. While there is no ambassador until he or she is appointed, so I perform his functions as acting ambassador. So basically, I need to work for two, both to perform my functions as political counselor and as a head of the embassy. So it is, we are very small embassy here in Oslo. In my view, too small compared to the level of support we receive from Norway. So we need to work hard and smart. In those 3 months I have been staying in Oslo, I have realized that there is a huge framework of people, organizations, ministries, agencies, NGOs, experts helping my country. And my primary task in the first few weeks here in Oslo was to make a clear distinction of what can keep working without the embassy or without me, and which are those processes or people or ministries to which I can add something, some added value. And as an official current representative of my country in this country, so I can go to Ministry of Defense or to Ministry of Foreign Affairs or to the Office of Prime Minister and to raise some issues which experts or NGOs cannot do that. That is basically what my efforts are focused on. So military support and economic support are two main fields of my activity here in Oslo. And of course, supporting a political dialogue, which is always necessary to keep things moving ahead for military and economic. And the most recent visit by President Zelensky to Oslo was a good example of how this political dialogue helps pushing that forward.
Yeah, because when Mr. Zelensky came here last week, to almost everyone's surprise, I guess some people knew about it from before. Like, how early are you involved in the plans?
So personally, me, I was involved from the very beginning because I was a big part of sharing information on preparations for this visit. It was planned well ahead, so it was not like fast lightning decision on a couple of days ahead before. Also because we had a multilateral Nordic summit as a part of this bilateral visit, so of course Norway had to agree with other Nordic countries as well to invite them. So I cannot disclose when the decision was taken, but it was weeks ahead. It was not a last-minute decision.
How was it to have your president visit Norway when you're leading the embassy? Was it mostly a lot of stress on work, or was it sort of were you able to feel that this was a great moment in the relationship between our countries? Or how was your experience of the visit?
I would say both of them. Yeah. So those were challenging days for me and the entire embassy. Again, because we are a small embassy. Yeah. So it is much easier when you have 20 people, but when you have 4 people in the embassy, that is something you had to cope with. We had a very professional advance team which arrived from Kyiv, which did a major part of job. They knew what they were doing because they always organize such kind of visits. Yes, it has been a big step forward in our bilateral relations. If I'm correct, that is only the second visit of President of Ukraine to Norway in the 30 years. The first one took place in 2016. And the visit was, among others, intended to express gratitude on the highest possible level to Norway and Norwegian people for all the support we have received and we are expecting in future. There were fruitful, substantial discussions with the government, with Sturting, with the leaders of political parties represented in Sturting. So public speech to the parliament and press conferences were good opportunities to deliver some key messages to Norway and its people. The Nordic Summit was an excellent platform to share our views, to strengthen coordination, because as I said, we need to be very smart and effective in using resources we receive. So we always need to talk a lot how to make better use of what we have at our disposal. And now, following the visit, I have a number of tasks to implement. That is a good contribution to my activity here. We have launched, I would say, several new projects in our bilateral relations. So yeah, it was a big step for us as an embassy and for our countries in general.
Is any of those new initiatives possible to share, or are they too secret?
Not yet. No, not yet.
I'm sure you'll tell us when the time is here. But I guess also the contrast from coming from the US, where they can't kind of agree with themselves on the support for Ukraine, and then coming to Norway and meeting all the Nordic countries, it has to be quite a big contrast. Like Denmark announced one of its, if not the biggest, military aid assistance to Ukraine during those visits. So it has to be like not night and day, but it has to be like a much nicer for the Ukrainian delegation to work with people like that, like receive those news, I guess.
As I said, this bilateral visit was planned weeks ahead. So it was not supposed to be in between the US and Brussels.
Of course, like it was not, yeah.
So it was not the intention to, you know, to demonstrate this like difference between the current state in the US and the current state in Norway. Also, we, of course, are optimistic. We have to be optimistic to win the war. We are optimistic on the discussions in Brussels. We do hope that the discussions in Washington will end sooner than later, because the US, yes, remains number one in leading and coordinating this international support. And too many countries are watching. Mm. Of course, they are watching. So within the EU, as you might have heard, we had a huge breakthrough. Mm. We have formally opened negotiations on accession. And that was also a situation which marked the visit to Oslo, because it was the day before. So many discussions taking place also during the visit were also devoted to the forthcoming meeting of the European Council.
And also expression in Norway, and I guess also in the international press, is that a lot of people call this Putin's war. Like, it's called Putin's war in Ukraine, and they put kind of his face on the war, that without Putin, this war would never happen and it would not go on. Like, they don't say Russia's war on Ukraine. Do you have any thoughts on the difference between those two ways to describe what's happening?
The problem is that when we talk about the decision to start a full-scale invasion, and even the decision of 2014, yes, it is mostly Putin's decision. But then when it has already started, now if, for instance, Putin dies tomorrow, the war will most probably not be ended the same day. Because for 24 years of his reign, of his rule, Putin has built a huge totalitarian regime in which it is much easier to replace one guy on the top than to change the system itself. And so in this case, in fact, no one knows what would happen if Putin dies tomorrow, whether the war will end immediately or sooner than with Putin, or even later than with Putin, because no one knows who will replace them. We understand more or less that most probably the system will remain. It could be somehow changed, but no one should expect a democratic Russia, I would say. This is simply, they tried to do it in the 1990s. And the Russian nation is simply not okay with democracy. They simply got used to have one leader which takes the decision for them. That is not the way in which they would see their own country. So that is a complex question. We also need to be aware of making a big difference between Putin's war and Russia's war, because those are Russian soldiers implementing, fulfilling the orders. Those are Russian pilots dropping air bombs on kindergartens, hospitals, and schools, and peaceful cities. Those are Russian companies and also foreign companies working in Russia, fulfilling the orders of the Russian government, financing the war. Those are countries across the globe which keep buying Russian fossil fuels, financing the war. So there are many stakeholders which allow this war to continue.
Yeah, and if you look at the history of Russia, Putin has to have the heaviest responsibility for this war, but Russian imperialism has been a problem for several hundred years. It's not a new phenomenon.
Exactly.
And you see the biggest opposition leader of Putin, Navalny, if he's still alive, we don't know. He is for democratic reform, but he's also supporting Russian imperialism. He claims that the Crimea is Russian.
He said that you can't split it up like a sandwich, I guess.
Yes.
I think that was the quote. But also afterwards, he has gone back on that and said that he wants to transfer Crimea back to Ukraine, but just to kind of balance it a little bit. But that's correct
he
what
has,
you're saying.
He has also some statements about Georgia that isn't very nice. So I agree. And it's important to put the responsibility on Putin, but we shouldn't let the rest of the Russian elite or society get off for free, because this is a massive war and everyone that has a chance to stop it bears the responsibility. But there are some brave souls in Russia that are setting alight factories and stuff. Some of them are maybe Ukrainian special forces, we don't know. But there's a lot of stuff happening in Russia that could be Russian opposition as well. So
I'm not sure if you can share some secrets about that.
No, I cannot.
Worth a try.
Yeah.
But also, I think we have to, we're coming close to the end for our talk. But for the people listening to this podcast and other Norwegians, what can they do to support your country? Do you have any thoughts on that?
As I said, I see huge numbers of people and organizations doing that already. So the first days of the full-scale invasion, the embassy was full with box, but now there is a separate big warehouse full of boxes. I mean, the humanitarian assistance keeps going. Trucks keep going to Ukraine with humanitarian assistance from different organizations, from medics, from firemen, from regular Norwegians supporting that. So my big message to everyone listening to me is to thank you for everything you have done. Please keep doing that, because we really need that. We are still in the biggest land and also in sea and air warfare since the Second World War in Europe. And the destruction is that big that we will need many years to recover it. We do our best inside Ukraine, but any external assistance is, of course, also much appreciated.
So I want to end sort of on a high note. So this question is some recommendations for the future, because I believe that Ukraine will liberate all their territories. And when that happens, as you mentioned, there's a lot of people all around the world that now thinks a lot about Ukraine, wants to support you and knows about Ukraine that probably hadn't heard about the country before this full-scale invasion. So when Ukraine in the not too distant future has liberated all its territory and is completely free, there will be a lot of people that would want to come visit Ukraine. What are your sort of recommendations? Where should, what places should they visit, and what should they see when they visit Ukraine?
Sure. If you go from Norway, I would suggest using planes.
Hmm.
Because like Norway, Ukraine has huge distances between cities, which are not that easy to cover by car. If of course, you're not going to spend several weeks in Ukraine. So if you have only several days, I would insist on using planes to do big trips. You would be really delighted to see Kyiv. My wife says that if I were not a diplomat, she would never leave Kyiv. of course, Lviv, the biggest city in Western Ukraine, as a part of this European Austrian architecture heritage, close to Poland, to Hungary, to Slovakia. So western part of the country is interesting because it has this combination of different cultures and different ethnic communities living there, and so mountains, Carpathian mountains. Kyiv is interesting, as I said, as itself, as a big European capital with a very interesting landscape with a big river. So you can take river cruises across the Dnieper River down with flow to the Black Sea. And of course, the southern part of Ukraine is very picturesque. Odessa is the biggest port. Southern part of Odessa region is a historic place of Bessarabia, which has also a unique combination of Romanian, Moldovan identities mixed. What else? There are historical places across Ukraine in which you would see Ukraine belonging to this European cradle and also to European medieval ages civilization. But as I said, you would need more time to reach those places. So try to start from big cities. You would see that infrastructure is really good. I mean, in the terms of hotels, taxis, restaurants, Kyiv, which I know best because I live in it, is really a restaurant mecca, I would say, with very affordable price and a very wide range of cuisine you could try. So just go ahead.
Yeah. I know that a lot of the international sort of solidarity movement for Ukraine is planning a big beach party in Crimea when that is liberated as well.
Yes. Definitely.
Yeah, we might have like the last episode of the Ukraine pod might be from.
Yeah, it will be on from a beach in Crimea.
But you're celebrating Christmas with your family in Norway, are you?
Or yes, going back here in Oslo.
Do you know what you're going to eat for Christmas?
So we have a small kid. She's only 10 months old. So it depends on whether.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It depends on whether my wife would be able to cook the entirety of dishes she's intending to.
Okay.
Because according to old Ukrainian traditions, on the Christmas evening, we need to have 12 different types of food on the table, including the one which is called kutia. Kutia is basically a mix of different cereals. Each family had its own understanding of what cereals and in which proportion should be used for that kutia. So kutia could be sweet with some addition of sugar or honey. It could be salty. It could be boss. So you could use it as a dessert following the main dishes, or you could use it as a main dish.
Yeah.
Because as cereals, you can just eat it as a main dish. So we will see whether we will manage to accommodate this 12 dishes requirement for Christmas evening. What is interesting is that we switched to celebrating Christmas on the 24th of December, like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Because before that, we have been using an old church calendar and celebrating Christmas on the 6th and 7th of January. like a couple of European nations also still do that way. Then it was some transition period in which families were celebrating both dates and the end of December and the beginning of January. And now most have switched to December, so now it goes in parallel. And now we also start celebrating with Christmas, and then the New Year comes.
I remember when I was an election observer in 2004 during the Orange Revolution that there wasn't that many people celebrating Christmas on the 24th.
Mm, yes.
But all of us election observers, it was 2 days before the elections, we were out at restaurants that day celebrating Christmas. So it's interesting that you've made that switch now.
Yes.
And how do you say Merry Christmas in Ukraine?
Щасливого Різдва.
One more time?
Щасливого Різдва.
Okay, I think we'll end with that. Yeah. So I'm not going to try to repeat it because then we're going to spend another 10 minutes on this episode. So, God jul.
God jul.
And thank you.
Yes, thank you.